Welcome to episode 4 of the Fredcast. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In today's episode of the Fredcast, we're going to start with the news. Following that, I have an interview with Emily Metzloff, who performed quite an amazing feat on her bicycle, and she's going to tell you about it in her own words. After that, a couple of follow-ups, some listener feedback, and our shout-outs. So sit back, relax, and if you're cycling, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Okay, we've got a lot to cover today, so let's get right down to it. First story is important if you have a handlebar stem made by the company Syntace. That's S-Y-N-T-A-C-E. Syntace announced a few days ago that they're recalling about 2,300 F99, or so-called Force 99, bicycle handlebar stems. According to the company, the stems can crack or break under normal conditions, causing the rider to fall and suffer serious injury. Now, if you've got one of these, the way that you're going to tell that it's a Force 99, it's black. It has a production code of 0103 through 4504, and stems with no production code are included in the recall. The production code can be found at, in the bottom set of numbers located on the end of the stems. The stems were sold by a variety of bicycle dealers, mail order magazines, etc., from May 2003 through July 2005, and they cost about $90. Now, this was a voluntary recall, and it was done in association with the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and I have put links to both the CPSC's website and Syntace's website in the show notes. If you're interested, you can contact Syntace at their 800 number. That's 800-448-3876, and when you call, ask for extension 233. Or you can email them or contact them on their website at syntaceusa.com. So if you have a Syntace stem on your bike, I recommend that you stop riding until you have a chance to make sure whether or not it is one of the recalled stems. And if you have any doubt, don't ride your bike until you have a chance to contact the company and find out whether your handlebar stem is one of the recalled items. Well, the dispute between the UCI and the Grand Tours continues, and now the teams are really starting to put pressure on both sides to meet. The teams met last week and urged reconciliation between the UCI and the Grand Tours. Basically, as long as the two sides are feuding, the teams are left wondering exactly what they're supposed to do this year. Here we have teams with amazing talent and multi-million dollar budgets right in the middle of one side, the UCI, that's saying that if the Grand Tours continue on their path, that they're going to run the Pro Tour without the Grand Tours. And on the other side of the riders, we have the Grand Tours, who are saying that they're going to organize their own competition among themselves, and that they're going to have their own prizes and their own calendar and their own purse. And now these teams can't figure out which side they're supposed to go with. So instead, they're urging reconciliation and that the two sides come back together at least through the 2008 season, and that they're hoping that between now and that time, they're going to be able to come back together and come up with some sort of a compromise. So this is going to continue for some time, folks, unfortunately, and we'll keep watching it here on the Fredcast. Couple of pieces of news from the upcoming Amgen Tour of California. As you know, this event's going to start taking place in February, and it's going to bring pro-level cycling to the West Coast. And finally this week, the actual route for the course was announced. As you know, the Amgen Tour of California is going to travel from San Francisco to Redondo Beach, and it's a 600-mile ride. It begins on February 19th, and it's what they're touting as a Tour de France-style race with 16 professional cycling teams traversing the California coast from north to south over 8 days. And basically, if you go to the website, and I've put links in the show notes, you're going to find out exactly where these routes are going to go through from day to day. And I looked at it, and I've ridden some of this course at various centuries and events that I've done myself. And they're doing some of the most beautiful parts of California, as well as some of the most challenging parts from a cycling perspective of California. One of the things that's kind of neat is that they're also going through the Solvang area, which is the site of perhaps the world-famous Solvang Century, which takes place every spring here in California, and is also the location where the Discovery team has been training for the last few years. So I don't know whether or not that's going to give Discovery any sort of an advantage in the race, but I will tell you that I think that it's going to be just a fantastic race, and I think that it's going to be a fantastic course. So in a nutshell, here's exactly what it's going to look like. The race begins with about a 2-mile time trial along the Embarcadero in San Francisco. The next stages take the 128 competitors through Sausalito, Santa Rosa, Martinez, San Jose, Monterey, and San Luis Obispo. Now, from there, they'll take a 4-mile climb to the San Marcos Pass during the fifth stage, and they'll descend into the Santa Barbara coast. The sixth stage ends at Amgen's headquarters in Thousand Oaks, California, and the following final day, the race ends with a 10-lap circuit course race in Redondo Beach, California. And I have a feeling that in Redondo Beach, with a kind of race like this and with the amount of coverage it's going to get, including coverage on ESPN, I have a feeling that that race in Redondo is going to be just packed with spectators. So if you're interested in going, you might want to pack a lunch, get there early, and stake out your spot. Now, if you want to be insured of a decent spot at some of these races, some of the stages, the Amgen Tour of California is also looking for volunteers. They have a wide variety of different positions available, and they're all listed in pretty decent detail on the Tour of California website. Unfortunately, I'm probably going to be out of town that week when it's going through, so I'm probably going to miss it. Otherwise, I would love to take a couple of days off from work and go either be a spectator or perhaps a volunteer. They've got some positions for course marshals and some credentialing people. I just think it would just be a whole lot of fun. So if you've got the time and you're interested, check out the website. I've put a link into the show notes for today's show, and maybe go out there and volunteer. And by the way, if you are planning on going to the Tour of California, I would be really interested in maybe having you send in an audio comment or maybe make a recording from the course, and I'd be happy to play any of that right here on the Fredcast. So if you want to be a reporter for us, go ahead, go out there, make a recording, send it in, and we'll get it up here on the show. Well, it's that time of the week. Time for the obligatory Lance Armstrong stories. You remember a couple of weeks ago I talked to you about the fact that Lance was facing possible jail time in Italy in a defamation case brought by Filippo Simeoni. Well, this week comes news from Paris, saying that a Paris court has refused to hear a defamation charge brought by Filippo Simeoni against Lance Armstrong. Judicial officials in Paris revealed on Monday that the statute of limitations had expired and suggested that Simeoni's lawyers had misinterpreted French law. Now, you'll remember that this is all about the fact that Lance criticized Simeoni, who was an Italian cyclist, in an interview with Le Monde in 2003. Despite the ruling in Paris, Lance is still facing a March 7th trial in Italy on civil charges of defaming Simeoni. So I'll keep an eye on that one as it comes up, but Lance dodges a bullet in France. The second story about Lance is actually more about Jan Ulrich. You'll recall that Jan and Lance were perennial rivals at the Tour de France. And what's really interesting is Lance gave an interview last week to the German newspaper Bild. And in the interview, they asked Lance who they thought was most likely to win the Tour de France this year. And initially, you'll probably remember that Lance was talking about Ivan Basso being the one who was most likely to succeed him as the Tour de France champion and to wear the final yellow jersey on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. Interesting, however, that Lance was quoted as saying, "I predict that Jan will win the 2006 tour with a 4 or even 5 minute gap. That is really, really amazing." Ulrich has repeatedly been overshadowed by Lance since Jan's victory 9 years ago. But it sounds like Lance really believes that Jan has a chance to win now. Lance, at the end of the interview, said that all of the tactics that Discovery used in Lance's, or Discovery and Postal Service, I must say, in Lance's victories, all their plans and all their tactics were planned with one aim, and that was to put Ulrich in difficulty so that Ulrich, Lance's main rival, wouldn't be able to catch up with Lance, thereby allowing Lance to win. So there you have it, Lance's prediction for this year in the Tour de France. He predicts Jan Ulrich with a yellow jersey. Speaking of racing news, one of the first major tour events of the year is underway right now in Australia. It's the Jacobs Creek Tour Down Under, and it's going on through this Sunday. Interestingly enough, Prelude was won by Australian Robbie McEwen. Stage 1 was won by Australian Simon Gerrans. And Stage 4 was won by Australian Alan Davis. So the Australians dominating the Tour Down Under, which is not really a surprise considering the fact that a lot of the teams down there are Australian teams. But that's not to say that the majors aren't represented there as well, because there's a wide variety of major teams that are indeed in the Tour Down Under, including such well-known team names as Liberty Seguros, Credit Agricole, AG2R, Davitamon Lotto. So there's a lot of major teams down there. And if you want to find out more about the Tour Down Under, and if you want to follow the race through its ending on Sunday of this week, I'm putting a link in the show notes so that you can go to the website where you can follow the results live or check up on news of everything that's gone on this week in the Tour Down Under down in Australia. Now, another major international cycling event that's going on this week is the Tour of Siam, which is taking place in Thailand. It's another stage race style event, and it is the first cycling event in Thailand this year. What's interesting about this, you'll remember last week I mentioned the tragedy that occurred in Wales when 4 amateur cyclists were killed as they were setting out on a 60-mile ride. Well, the Wales Commonwealth Games cycling team is paying tribute to those 4 riders who were killed by wearing black armbands during the week-long Tour of Siam, which goes through this Sunday, January the 21st. The Wales team, after the ride, will then have a week at home before flying out to the Tour of Langkawi in Malaysia and then building toward the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne. Also reading on the internet, it turns out that just a few days ago was the final funeral for the 4 members of that cycling club in Wales that were killed. And apparently many of the mourners at each funeral attended all 4 of those funerals, and it really has become much of a national tragedy for the people of Wales. So it's nice to see that the professional cyclists are behind the amateur cyclists at this very sad time in Welsh cycling. And finally in the news tonight, somebody that personally I wish we had here in Los Angeles. This guy is sort of a cycling angel, if you ask me. Here's a gentleman who only wants to be known by the name Panjang, who lives in Malaysia. He is completely fed up with the increasing number of potholes all over the city where he lives in Malaysia, especially during the rainy season. He's 63 years old, rides around on a bicycle, and he looks for potholes. When he finds the potholes, first he fills them with stones and pebbles, and then he comes back and seals them with cement. I don't know about you, Here in Los Angeles, we have potholes everywhere. And it's interesting, when I ride around from the various cities and from the county of Los Angeles into the city of Los Angeles, I can always tell when I've hit the city of LA, because that's when I'm always worried about getting flats, because the potholes get really, really bad. And for those of you in other parts of the United States and in other parts of the world where perhaps you get a lot of rain or a lot of snow, which tends to undermine the asphalt, and that's what causes these potholes, I don't know about you, but here in Los Angeles, and perhaps where you live, we could use a number of panjangs. Okay, well, that's going to do it for the news for today. Next up, I have an interview that I did a few days ago with a young lady by the name of Emily Metzloff. And Emily is definitely somebody that I would consider a long-distance cyclist. And when you hear about her feat in her own words, you'll understand what I'm talking about. I did the interview by Skype. She was in her home in North Carolina, and I was here in Los Angeles. So enjoy the interview with Emily. Okay, we're all set. We are talking to Emily Metzloff. And Emily, give everybody a little bit of an introduction into why it is I wanted to talk to you. What's this feat that you did that I think we all want to hear about?
Okay. Well, I was in the Peace Corps in Honduras, and while I was there, I met one of my best friends, Sarah Monger, and we went on a lot of bike trips in Honduras, and one day decided that, you know, we should ride home to the States instead of taking our airplane ticket.
And whose idea was that?
You know, neither of us can really remember.
You guys were just sitting around one day, maybe having a drink or something, and you thought, gee, let's ride home.
Yeah, we just had so much fun biking around and seeing Honduras, and we said, you know, we should ride home.
Now, were you guys long-distance cyclists before you went to Honduras, or cycling was just something you did for fun?
Mostly just for fun. I think Sarah had gone on a week-long bike tour in California, but I had never been on anything, you know, more than a couple of days.
And when whatever you did that was just a couple of days long, what kind of distances were involved? I mean, nothing like this. What was the total distance on this ride?
The total distance is about 3,100 miles.
And how long did it take you to do 3,100 miles?
About 2.5 months.
Wow. That's a long time on a bike.
Yep.
The question you probably get asked the most was, you know, have you been back on a bike since? And how did your rear end feel after all those miles?
Yeah, I have been back on a bike since. I'm now home in North Carolina, and it's a little bit colder here, so biking's a little bit more challenging for me. But yeah, I loved biking, and I missed being on that trip.
Now, the bikes that you used on this ride, were these bikes you brought with you or bikes that you picked up in Honduras?
We bought them in Honduras, in the capital. They're Trek. I have a Trek mountain bike, so it's not necessarily what you'd like for touring, but it did the trick.
Well, I have to think that the roads probably weren't that great, so having a mountain bike was probably definitely something you wanted to have with you.
Yeah. Mostly we were on paved roads. We did maybe 30 miles total on unpaved roads, but mostly we stuck to the paved roads, and, you know, they were decent. Some of them better than others, for sure.
Now, before we get into your ride, because that's probably what my listeners want to hear the most about, but I'm interested, what were you doing in the Peace Corps? What kind of a job did you have?
I was a youth development volunteer, and I was working at a youth center in western Honduras, everything from teaching life planning skills to teaching computer classes and just kind of whatever the community wanted from me at the youth center.
Now, you know, for those of us who are in the U.S., and a lot of my listeners obviously have a lot of computer access, what is the computer access like for the people that you were working with in Honduras?
There were internet cafes, which were, they charged about $1 an hour. And it was I saw it just improve a whole lot just in the 2 years that I was there, from just really, really slow connections and nobody using the internet cafes. But by the time I left, there were tons of kids getting involved and everything from chatting to doing their homework on the internet.
And that's great, because you had a part in getting those kids involved in those computer skills. You're really giving them skills that they'll be able to use as they grow older.
I hope so.
Which is great. Good for you for doing that. So I'm a dad. I have two daughters, and you know, when I first heard about you doing this, I thought to myself, I'm not so sure I'd let my girls do that. Tell me a little bit about how your parents felt about you, you know, doing this ride all the way up Central America.
Well, I think my dad had the same reaction that you would have. He was very concerned, and could think of a bunch of different reasons, you know, why it was unsafe. And we talked it out. I think Sarah and I did everything we could to minimize the risk. You know, we didn't ride at night. We did as much research as we could to figure out our route. But I think my mom was a little bit more supportive and, you know, trusted my, I think she thought that if, you know, I thought that it was going to be okay, then I should go for it.
Now, some of the places that you rode through, I mean, I read, for instance, that you rode through Chiapas in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, and there have been, you know, there have been some issues in that part of the country for a while. What was the scariest thing on your whole ride, or what was the one time when you thought to yourself, gee, maybe this wasn't such a good idea?
We really didn't have too many scary moments. There was one time when we were riding and we were in a little bit of an isolated area and three guys were just kind of talking to us and wouldn't really leave us alone. But, you know, we got to the next town and, you know, just went into a restaurant and they went away. But, you know, that wasn't even that big of a deal. Both, you know, it made us both a little bit nervous. But nothing too serious at all.
Well, that's as a dad, I'm glad to hear that it was a pretty safe ride for you. What would you say was the highlight of your trip?
The highlight, you know, we were on the road for 70 something days, and you know, each day was just, there was something about each day, so it's hard to pick one highlight. But one of the rides that I loved the most, we were on the Gulf Coast in Mexico, and we had picked a road to avoid one of the main highways, but there was a little bit hole on the map, so we weren't completely sure if the road was going to keep going or not, but we decided to try our luck anyway. And it ended up being just one of the most beautiful rides ever, because we were on the sandbar, and one side we were looking out over the ocean, and one side we were looking out over this bay with surrounded by palm trees. And I don't know, that was one of my favorite rides, because nobody would have gotten to see that if they weren't adventurous and out on a bike. So that was one of the highlights for me.
That sounds fantastic. But it brings up a good question, and that is, how did you plan this ride? I mean, here you were in Honduras and deciding to ride all the way back to the U.S. Did you you know, use guidebooks or the internet or friends back home? How'd you plan the whole thing?
Yeah, well, one of the frustrating things was I couldn't find any comprehensive resource on biking in Mexico, and there was no book or anything. I mean, because if you're biking across the states, there's tons of books and resources about that. But for Mexico, there were a lot of travel logs on the internet about people who had biked through Mexico, but they didn't necessarily choose the route that we chose. So it was really, you know, we did our best to get information from bikers who had already done the trip, and we read some travel books, but, you know, it was difficult to research it completely.
So when you left, I mean, did you know pretty much what your route was going to be, or were there some spots, like you just mentioned, where, you know, you figured we'll figure it out when we get there?
A little bit of both. We had a pretty general idea of where we wanted to go and what roads we would be on, but a lot of times we just had to ask people and get their advice on what would be the best route to take.
Okay, so here you are in Honduras. You've been living there for 2 years. You decide you're going to ride home. You have all your possessions, you know, that you've had for 2 years. What did you actually take with you on your bikes, and how did you outfit your bikes for this long ride?
Well, both of us had trailers, bob trailers, and I was lucky because my brother came down a couple weeks before I left on my trip, so he took home all the stuff that I wasn't going to take on my trip. But we had a tent, some clothes, a book, cooking supplies, And yeah, that was all, it all fit in the trailers that we had.
So how many pounds do you figure you were pulling each day?
We think about 40, 50.
Okay, so that's not too bad. I mean, it's, you know, it's no different than somebody going on a long backpacking trip across Europe or something, except you're on a bike.
Yikes.
Okay, so that's not bad. So here you are, you're riding through Central America, and all of a sudden, and obviously because you guys certainly spoke Spanish, as you're riding through, you're meeting people. What were people's reactions to you? I mean, did they think that you were just these two crazy Americans, or did they welcome you in their homes? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, a little bit of both. They definitely thought we were crazy, and especially because we were two women, they couldn't really, they couldn't fathom it. But we also found a lot of people that just really admired what we were doing, and I hope, you know, they were inspired, if not to do exactly what we were doing, but to kind of break out of their bubble a little bit.
And what about people? I mean, you'd get to towns, and I mean, I read your blog, and I could see that there were places where you camped out at night. There were places where you found hotels. But the two that I thought were probably the most interesting that I read was there was one family. They sounded very poor, and they invited you to stay in their home. And that just sounded, I mean, incredible to me. I wonder how many Americans would do that if somebody was just walking down their street.
Yeah.
If they'd invite them into
the
their homes.
Yeah, the hospitality in Mexico and in Honduras was just is phenomenal. People would, that was fairly common. Also in Honduras, we'd be stuck in some situation and people would just invite us into their homes and feed us, and just seems like they had no concern about their safety or, you know, even if they were poor, they would just be willing to give, you know, everything they had to us.
That's fantastic. The second one that I really enjoyed reading about, although it was probably weird at the time, was waiting for the comandante.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that day.
Well, that was when we showed up in a small town. We had guessed that there probably wouldn't be a hotel. And so we'd asked this one man if it would be okay if we camped in his yard. And he said that he wasn't able to give us permission for that because he didn't own the house, but he suggested that we go to the police station or in the mayor's office to see if they could help us. So we did go, and we met one of the police officers, and he said that he thought that it would probably be okay for us to stay in the police office, but we needed to wait for the command or the comandante to show up for the final approval. And so we waited about 2.5 hours outside, and it was kind of a big spectacle. Everybody's coming and trying to see what we're doing and what we're up to. And finally the guy came, and he said it would be fine if we slept in the police station. So we did.
That's amazing. Here you are sleeping. Again, I don't think we'd ever hear of in the United States. Just here, no problem.
Yeah.
Take this room here in the police station. You can sleep there for the night.
Right.
That's really neat. What was your longest day, what was your toughest day? Tell us a little bit about that, because a lot of my listeners are endurance cyclists, people who go out and do, you know, centuries and double centuries. So tell us a little bit about your most difficult day.
The toughest day for us was, you know, toughest days, really. We were in Baja, California, and most people that bike Baja, they go south, and we were going north just because, you know, that was out of necessity. But the headwinds we had there were just terrible, terrible, terrible. And not every day, but at least half of the days that we were biking up Baja, it slowed us down to about a quarter of the speed that we were normally going before. And so this one day, we'd had two whole days of it and pushed through. But on the third day, it was just terrible, terrible and cold. And we had made like 10 miles in 4 hours, which is so slow, and we weren't anywhere close to a town where we could stay. We were out in the middle of nowhere, and so that was a day that we actually had to hitchhike. And we, at one point, Sarah just turned around and she said, "We can't do this anymore. What do we do?" And so we thought about either, you know, riding and having the tailwinds and going back the 10 miles to where we came from, and we thought about hitchhiking. And we decided to hitchhike.
Probably a good decision at that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I personally did a century yesterday, and we had huge headwinds for 50 miles. It was an out and back course. And the whole time I'm thinking, you know, for me at least, you know, I could turn around or I could keep going, but I always had that out. There was always that SAG vehicle there that could have picked me up. And here you were in the middle of Baja. There's no SAG vehicles there for you. So your decision, I think, was a little harder.
Yeah, there's no SAG vehicle. There's not even anywhere to pull over. So it was just, and, you know, we were so far away from any town that we could even, you know, get out of the wind.
Now, what did you do? You know, you mentioned that some of the places you went, and the people took you into their homes and they fed you. But for the most part, what'd you do for food? And more importantly, maybe, what'd you do for drinkable water?
Well, for water, we always stocked up in the morning. We both had camelbacks, and we probably both had about 5 liters of water on us to start out. And we'd usually just buy that in the morning. And then usually we'd come across somewhere where we could buy some more water, or people would give us water.
Mm-hmm.
And as for food, we'd eat breakfast in our hotel room or wherever we were, and then we'd stop on the road, and usually it was eggs and beans and tortillas for lunch, and then we'd eat out once we got to our destination for the day.
So I guess the big question is, this is a lot of miles in a short period of time, and obviously it's cold right now, so you're not doing a lot of cycling, but when the spring comes and it gets a little nicer, are you planning on continuing long-distance cycling?
I hope so. I hope. I'd like to ride across the states one of these days, and I want to find a partner to do that with me, and you know, if not that, I want to compete in some centuries and other races.
So cycling, you're not done with cycling. You have a lot more cycling in you.
No, definitely not.
Good.
Just starting really.
What's next for you and Sarah? What are your plans? You just got out of the Peace Corps, so your life is really ahead of you. What are you thinking about doing in the future?
Yeah, I'm in North Carolina looking for a job. I'd like to do something where I can use my Spanish and be involved in the community. And I'm just going to have to see what comes up. And I think Sarah's applied to grad school for teaching.
And lastly, is this the kind of trip you'd recommend to most people? Is this something that you think a lot of people should do and experience? And if so, what tips would you give them as somebody who's now had this, you know, 3,100-mile experience?
I would definitely recommend it for people who are adventurous and willing to deal with, or people who are who can take it. But you've got to be able to speak Spanish and kind of roll with the flow down there. And you've got to be pretty flexible about where you sleep and you know, not be too bummed if the roads aren't what you'd imagined. But you
it's
know,
not for the Ritz-Carlton types. You're saying it's not for the Ritz-Carlton types, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And what kind of tips would you give people who were contemplating something like this?
Do it. don't be afraid of the risks, and you know, life is for living, and to go for it.
I think that's a good tip right there. I think that's fantastic. I want to thank you very, very much for taking the time to do this. I know that all of my listeners are going to be really, really interested to hear what you have to say. And I just wish you a lot of luck in the future in whatever it is that you do. And if you don't mind, I'm going to point my listeners to your website where your blog is so that they can read a little bit more about what you did. And if you're interested, you can find information about my podcast at www.thefredcast.com. And I probably will have it up and available for listening in a couple of days. So, again, thank you so much for your time and just a lot of luck in the future.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, well, I hope you really enjoyed the interview with Emily. I really enjoyed doing it. I was just fascinated by what they did. And if you want more information on their ride and just sort of a day-by-day accounting of the ride from Central America to San Diego, you can find a link to Emily's blog on the show notes. And in there, you're going to find really detailed information about their ride, as well as a number of pictures of Emily and Sarah as they made their way from Honduras all the way up to San Diego. Okay, so last week I told you that I was about to participate in the Wells Fargo Stagecoach Century, and I just wanted to sort of give you a wrap-up and review of the ride. This, it turns out, is the second year of the Stagecoach Century. Last year, on the inaugural ride, they had about 170 or 200 cyclists, and this year it definitely grew quite a bit because they had over 1,200 cyclists participating in the ride. Now, it takes place in Ocotillo, California, which is about midway between San Diego and Yuma, Arizona. And it takes place on the old Wells Fargo Stagecoach route that they used to take in the 1800s. Now, the nice thing about the ride, there's no route sheet for this ride because there's no turns. It is a straight out-and-back course, and it's all on the same road. It's a little San Diego County local road. There's one stop sign, straight out and back course, 50 miles out, 50 miles back. Within the first mile, I got a little bit of taste of what I was in for on the ride because there was a very strong headwind, and that headwind stayed with us for the entire 50-mile ride out to the end where we had to turn around. That made for some very, very hard going, and it was exceedingly slow. I think on the course on the way out there, I probably averaged maybe 15 miles an hour. It was just really, really slow. On the way back, had a nice tailwind for about two-thirds of the way, and then the wind shifted to a crosswind and sometimes a headwind, and so that made for slow going. In the end, finished in about 6 hours, which was pretty good considering the headwind. There was about 5,300 feet of climbing, but all in all, it was a beautiful day. The sky was blue. The desert scenery was just phenomenal. Yeah, granted, I wouldn't want to be there in July, August, or September, but it was just a gorgeous ride. And I was just watching clouds forming and disappearing over the mountains. It was just really beautiful. So meanwhile, back in Los Angeles, it was raining cats and dogs, and down there near the Mexican border, we were just having a phenomenal ride. And if you're in Southern California, I definitely recommend signing up and doing this one again in 2007.
Hi, David. I'm a Fred, too. And like you, I've been eagerly waiting the Garmin Edge 305. And I've got some news for you regarding that. I saw it at the Consumer Electronics Show, and it's awesome. And you were mentioning that you were disappointed in the lack of Mac support. Well, I've got good news for you on that front. I was at Mac World last week, and Garmin is going to support that baby on the Macintosh. So all your issues are flying out the window. The Garmin 305 is awesome, man. It's totally cool, and I checked it out. Take it easy, Dave. Love the show. It's really good, man. Take it easy. Bye.
Okay, and that was a voicemail from listener Torv. And Torv, I just want to thank you for sending us all that information about the Garmin Edge 305. I am waiting on pins and needles for mine to arrive that should be here any day, and I'm going to bring everybody information on that on the Fredcast. And thanks a lot for all of that information, as well as for the really kind comments about the Fredcast. And at the end of the show, for those of you who haven't sent me a voicemail or haven't sent me any email, I will be giving you all of that information on how to contact me. And I really do love getting those voicemails and emails. So again, Torv, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it. Okay, got a correction from another listener to something I mentioned in my last show. I was talking about the BP MS-150, which takes place down in Texas every year and gets about 13,000 riders. And Sean from South Africa sent me an email and sent me a couple of links, which I'm going to be putting into the show notes, for a couple of rides down in South Africa, each of which get 30,000 cyclists. 30,000. That just has to be an amazing, amazing feeling. So, Sean, I appreciate you sending us that information. I've put links in the show notes so everybody can check those out. And if any of you down there do any of these rides, again, feel free to be one of our roving reporters. Sean, maybe you could do it. Send us a recording of what it is like to ride with 30,000 people. Really, really interesting. Thanks a lot, Sean. I appreciate the information. Now, before I get to the shout-outs tonight, there's one other issue I wanted to mention and sort of get your opinion. I was looking to register the domain fredcast.com. You all know that I have the fredcast.com registered. And so I went to see if I could register fredcast.com, and I saw that it was already registered. And so I also found that it wasn't currently being used. So I emailed the gentleman who owns that domain name, and I asked him whether or not he'd be interested in perhaps giving it up so that I could use it. And it turns out that he has plans, at least so he says, to do his own podcast called Fredcast, because apparently Fred is his nickname. and it's going to be about photography. And I told him, well, we already have a podcast, and it's, you know, going into its fourth episode called The Fredcast, and it would be kind of silly for both of us to have the same name of podcast. And basically, he offered to sell me his domain name, but for a price that I just thought, for somebody who's a podcaster, who I'm not making money at this, folks, I just thought it was kind of high. So I just wanted to get your opinion on that. What do you think about when there's somebody out there who is also thinking about having a podcast and using basically the same name that I have? Do you think I should pay his crazy price? Do you think I should just tell him to take a hike? Do you think we should come up with a better name than the Fredcast? And I'm certainly open to suggestions, although I kind of like it. Drop me a note. Drop me an email. Send me a voicemail. Certainly, please don't harass this guy. That's not cool. It wouldn't be really, really right of us to do that. But I just want to get your opinion on it when there's somebody else out there who wants to have a podcast and call it Fredcast. So let me know what you think. Okay, and as I tell you every week, finally, I love getting your emails and your voicemails and your comments on the website, and I just wanted to send a couple of shout-outs to some people out there who sent some really great comments and really great emails and voicemails this week. So shout-outs to Sean from South Africa, Randy in Alabama, Daniel from Pennsylvania, Henrik from Denmark, Mick from Liverpool, Susan, Greg from Lake Tahoe, John, Drew in Oregon, and Bob from Boston, and to everybody who sent emails and voicemails, I really appreciate it very much. And the way that you can contact me here at the Fredcast, I've got two things that I'm still trying to get up on the site. Number one is the Fredcast forums. Those are almost ready and almost ready to go up on the site. The second, I'm going to be putting up a Frapper site. And if you don't know what that is, it's a sort of a hack of the Google Maps, where I'm going to have a link on the site where you can go in and put your location onto a map that all the other Fredcast listeners can look at to see where all over the world our listeners are. So I'm going to be putting that up real soon. But as always, you can send me an email. The email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. You can always send a voicemail 24 hours a day to area code 206-203-FRED. Audio comments are always welcome. You can send those in the email, or you can go to the website, and as we just discussed, that's www.thefredcast.com. So thank you very much for listening. Thanks for staying subscribed. Thanks for all your great comments. I love doing this, and I love the fact that you love that I'm doing this. Coming up next, this week's PodSafe Cycling Music, it's a song called Feel the Life Mix by Trapdoor. Music comes to us from music.podshow.com. Links in the show notes, both to the Podshow site as well as to Trapdoor site. So as always, thanks again for listening. Enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.